I remember the first day when I stepped into St. Luke's Hospital. The pure white walls and the scent of antiseptics hung in the air with the low murmur of life and death. It was my first day as an entrant in this new city. I was keen yet anxious, entirely unaware that I was on the verge of something nightmarish. Charles was the first to greet me. He had been there for years and was supposed to train me. In the beginning, he was charming, even in a quiet, confident manner. He knew all protocols, every patient's name, and seemed deeply committed to his work. "You'll get used to working the night shift." His voice was smooth with a note of odd chill. However, the hardest of all is watching them go. Some of those elderly souls won't last much longer. I nodded, then completely unaware of how ominous were his words. As days passed by, I began to be apprehensive about him, and at times even somewhat impressed by Charles. His obsessive care for work, his passion, he showed up when I least expected him to, with a lingering gaze much longer than comfort would allow. It wasn't just his presence that made the foxes confusing. There was an increase in patient deaths. I initially dismissed this as coincidence. The hospital was essentially packed with old patients, many already sickly. Then I noticed something disturbing. Almost every patient who died suddenly had been visited by Charles minutes before their demise. There was no correlation. Some of their conditions were stable, some were even getting well, but all had one thing in common: Charles. One evening, I found him watching me as I read a patient's file. He smirked knowingly. "What's on your mind, Amy?" he asked, his voice low. I made myself smile.
"Just getting the hang of things."
"Nice," he said, stepping closer. "It's better to forget the details. Easier that way." That night, I had decided to have a closer watch on him. A few nights later, I had gone to take a break in the back alley when I sensed something blood-curdling. Charles was crouched down beside a dumpster, facing away from me. He was methodically doing something, and when I took a step forward for a better look, I gasped. He was ripping into a dead pigeon with a surgical blade, fingers stained crimson. His head shot up, his dark eyes piercing through mine. "What's wrong, Amy?" he asked, getting up slowly, knife still in his hand. I shook my head and slowly backed away.
I went out to get some air.
His lips curled into that strange smirk. Air does good for you. I hurried back inside, my heart pounding. Whatever was wrong with Charles, it wasn't just in my head. Days passed and the deaths continued. I started keeping notes, watching his every move. I noticed how he always seemed to be around when a patient took their last breaths. He would enter their room, sometimes alone, sometimes under the pretense of checking vitals. Moments later, the machines would beep their ominous tone, signaling the end. Days later, I followed him quietly from one ward to another. He didn't seem to notice me at first, but then came to an abrupt stop, as though sensing my presence. Turning his head slightly, he whispered, "You really shouldn't be out here by yourself, Amy." I froze. His voice was soft, but held something sinister underlying its gentle tone. I forced a laugh.
"I'm just checking on the residents."
He chuckled under his breath, continuing down the halls as if nothing had happened. Trembling, I held my pen and wrote another entry in my little black book. A few nights later, I saw him creeping into the supply unit. I felt my heart race as I quietly followed a decent distance away. I peered through a small glass window to see him filling his shirt pockets full of syringes. I knew my time was running short. That same night, I saw Charles walk into the room of an elderly patient who had only recently been admitted. There was a knot in my stomach with fear. I wanted to go in after him, to scream at him not to touch that patient, but was instead rooted to the floor in fear. I figured it would be best to get evidence first. The next morning, that patient was dead. No signs or symptoms had been expressed. No complications. He was just gone. I called the police. I explained everything. The pattern, the theft of the syringes, the suspicious actions of Charles. And they took me seriously, and we made a plan. I would stay on watch and call them when Charles made his next move. That night, I saw him again. He slipped another syringe into his pocket and headed towards the room of a man who had only been admitted the day before. I hastily messaged the officers waiting outside. With everything crammed with courage, I trailed behind him. I slowly stood just outside the door, looking through the small crack. What I saw made my stomach drop. Charles loomed over the patient as he whispered something I couldn't hear, standing there with a syringe as he prepared to inject.
"Stop!"
I continued, in a voice that rang through the room. He turned, his eyes dark, almost soulless. The syringe fit itself more snugly into his fingers. "Amy," he purred, "you mustn't be here." Before he could make his move, the police rushed in with a bang.
"Drop the syringe!"
one shouted. Charles clenched his jaw, his eyes darting to each officer and back to me. For a moment, I thought he might charge, but he hissed and dropped the syringe to a clatter on the floor. They were all over him, forcing him down. As they dragged him away, he turned his head toward me and smiled, a slow, knowing smile. "I'll see you around, Amy." I shuddered, wrapping my arms around myself now that reality began to hit. Charles was a monster, and I had witnessed him firsthand, but he had been caught. It was over, or so I had hoped. Even with Charles in custody, a certain tension still hung heavily over me. It was his twinkling words that visited me at night from shadowy corners, and there were nights I woke in a cold sweat, thinking I saw him lurking in a shadow somewhere inside my room. I told myself it was just paranoia, that he was locked away. But fear is a cunning thing. It digs itself in below the skin and refuses to let slip. And while I indeed wanted to believe that Charles was gone forever, there was a part of me lurking, waiting for the moment when his prophecy would come true. That one day, somehow, virtual or otherwise, I would come to see him again. Charles Cullen, a former nurse, is one of the most notorious serial killers in U.S. history. Cullen murdered at least 40 patients, though he confessed to killing up to 400. He worked in multiple hospitals across New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where he had access to vulnerable patients. Cullen used his position to inject lethal doses of drugs like digoxin and insulin, making his crimes difficult to detect. His killing spree went unnoticed for years, until 2003 at St. Luke's Hospital in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Cullen's friend, Amy Lauren, secretly cooperated with investigators, helping them gather evidence. Cullen was arrested on December 12, 2003, and confessed to his crimes. He was sentenced to 11 consecutive life sentences in prison, without the possibility of parole.
Hi, my name is Kumar, and I was raised in a small Indian village where the summer air was infused with the fragrance of fresh mangoes, and the land shimmered gold in the afternoon sunlight. Childhood was simple and beautiful. Cool winds blew on our faces. Friends and I ran through fields where the greenery spread endlessly, climbed trees, and swam in the clearest ponds reflecting the blue sky like mirror. Life was easy, worry-free, and full of laughter. Then, out of nowhere, village children started to go missing. It began as a whisper among the elders, then acquired the entire village. Initially, these missing cases were brushed off as unfortunate incidents, but soon the locals started to get scared. A boy from the next community went missing on his way home from school. One girl went to bring back a jug of water and never returned. Their parents searched, calling out, and the echoes could be heard across the village, but the police dismissed it as trivialities. They called them missing cases, but the police never truly searched. Things started to go down really soon. Parents forbade their children from staying outside for too long. Those of us still playing out now moved by twos and threes, trying to protect one another from the unknown power that snatched away our friends. A village that was once our playground started to feel different and darker. It was as if something sinister lurked in the corners that the sun couldn't touch. One evening, when I was seven, my best friend Hari and I lost track of time. We had been playing near the old banyan tree, laughing and chasing fireflies, not caring that the sun had dipped into the horizon. As I looked up, I noticed the sky orange, red with the hue of the dying sunlight. Warmer tones of the evening became cooler night blues. The fields were filled with the chirping of crickets, while eerie howls of coyotes danced in the air around us at a distance.
"We should take the shortcut through the woods," Hari suggested.
It wasn't the safest route, but it was the fastest way home. The thought of our mother scolding us for being late made us quick to agree. We started walking. Along with the sounds of our voices, we could hear the crunch of leaves under our feet. 5 minutes into the walk, we began hearing a distant crying. It was like the cry of a child. At first far, but then it became louder. Thinking a poor kid must be in trouble, Hari ran toward that sound. I had no other option than to follow him, but a red alarm had already activated in my mind. Who in the woods would be crying? A lost child? A ghost? Every ghost story we ever heard ran through my head. We got close to a big bush, and peeking through the leaves, we saw it in the damp earth. It was an old, shabby doll, button-eyed, glittering in the moon's dim light. The instant I stopped to touch it, the cry peeped again, clearer this time. The cry wasn't even of a child. It was coming from the doll. Hari smirked, thinking something must have made the doll move to let out that cry. But I wondered, what or who? We turned to leave when we heard footsteps behind us. There was a man, a tall, lanky man, standing under the glimmering moonlight. His partial face was curtained under the shadows of the tree branches above him. His eyes were wide, and he had this stretchy, unnatural, dragged grin. He whispered,
"Do you like toys? I have many more. Come with me and I'll show you."
My blood ran cold. Hari and I had heard the stories, the missing children, the stranger who lured them away. We shook our heads and turned to leave, but he moved fast. Before we could take another step, he appeared in front of us, blocking our way, his long fingers reaching into his pocket, pulling out chocolates.
"Come now, don't be afraid. Take these. I have plenty more."
His voice was smooth and coaxing, but there was something off about it, something that made me scared enough to never stay outside after dark.
"No!"
Hari suddenly yelled, grabbing my hand.
"Let's go, Kumar!"
We started to run, our feet pounding against the forest floor. My heart hammered against my ribs. I expected to hear some footsteps and feel his hands grabbing at our clothes, but as I glanced back, I saw something worse. He wasn't chasing us. He was standing still, and he was munching on something. At first, I thought it was the chocolates that he offered us, but then I noticed it. From a black plastic bag, he pulled something out, something dark, wet, and dripping with a thick red liquid. He stuffed it into his mouth, chewing slowly, savoring it. The way the thick residue ran down his chin, I got doubts about whether this guy's a real human being or not. It wasn't food. At least I won't call it food. I didn't scream. I couldn't. Hari dragged me forward, forcing me to move until we reached the edge of the woods, where the sight of the village lights finally made us feel safe. We ran home and told our parents. They listened, their faces pale with horror. But when they asked around the village, no one knew who the man was. A year later, my father got a job in the city and we moved away. Life changed. One evening, I got home from school and found my parents glued to the TV. The tone of the news anchor was one of grave seriousness, depicting a case that had shaken the entire country. A man had been caught, a man who had been kidnapping and murdering children along with a friend who was equally sick like him. 19 confirmed victims, some as young as 5. He had even confessed to eating their flesh. The screen flashed an image of him. It was the man from the woods, the one who had grinned at us, the one who had offered us chocolates. My legs grew weak. My mother turned to look at me, her eyes wide with horror. I lay awake that night, staring at the ceiling, haunted even now by thoughts that just couldn't let go. I had stared into the eyes of a monster and lived to tell the tale. I should have been one of them, but I wasn't. And to this day, I don't know why. Around 2006, cases of missing children began skyrocketing in a village of Noida, India, which was later termed as the Nithari Killings. A series of gruesome child murders and assaults came to light through this case. Cops investigated the cases and found out that the crimes were committed by Maninder Singh Pandher, a businessman, and his domestic help, Surinder Kohli, at Pandhander's bungalow in Nithari village. Police discovered human remains in drains near the house, leading to shocking revelations of abuse, murder, and cannibalism. Kohli admitted to luring, killing, and dismembering multiple victims, mostly children. Both were sentenced to death, but Pandher was later acquitted in some cases. The case exposed severe police negligence and the vulnerability of marginalized communities. I never truly wanted to believe that demons exist. Ghosts, perhaps. Spirits of the dead? In this world? Sure. But demons? They belong in horror movies and Sunday sermons, not in a three-bedroom house on Carolina Street in Gary, Indiana, of which I am a proud tenant. But they came anyway. It started with the flies, black, buzzing swarms of flies, appearing even when winter stood firm. Kill as many as I did and fumigate the house, they just kept coming back. This was no normal infestation. They were not to have been there. This was just the start. At night, I heard heavy boots climbing and descending the stairs, pacing the halls just outside my bedroom. The first few times, I thought it was one of my children getting a glass of water or going to the bathroom, but when I checked, they were sound asleep, their chests moving up and down in utter, merciful ignorance. The footsteps continued, and they wouldn't stop. Not even when I had locked every door and window and suspended myself from prayer. Then my children changed. First, it was little things. My daughter talked to invisible friends in whispered tones, her eyes darting to the darkest corners of the room as if something lurked there. The youngest woke up in the morning with deep fingernail scratches on his arms and legs, his sheets twisted as if he had been fighting something in his sleep. But my eldest? He scared me the most. One night, he sat up in bed, foaming, still straight and motionless, and with a blank stare, I called his name. He turned his head slowly, very slowly, as if he were straining to do so, until he was locked into his stare upon me. His smile was not that smile. It was the smile of something else. "Mama," he whispered, "he wants to play." The room became unbearably still, crushed under the invisible weight of something pushing against my skin. I could not move. My son, my baby, gave a guttural laugh that made bile rise in my throat. The spirit left suddenly, and my son, after blinking back the tears, looked around confused and began to cry. He couldn't tell me what had just happened. That was when I realized there was something evil in our house. So I went to the priest. Father Maginot listened to my story with a stern expression while I told him about everything strange that happened, the whispered voices and the shadows that slithered across the walls that should have been empty. He agreed to come out to the house, to bless it, and to drive whatever it was away. He lived to regret it. His complexion drained the moment he walked into the house. The air chilled, enough for our breath to be visible. He dipped holy water in every room, muttering prayers in hushed tones. Down in the basement, something growled. The walls quivered. Above us, the bulb exploded, snuffing our surroundings in total darkness. "This is not a ghost," he told me afterward. "This is something much worse." The Department of Child Services got involved when my children started missing school. When they arrived for their visit, they witnessed things I could barely explain. My youngest was lifted from the ground, an invisible force hoisting him into the air before he was flung across the room like a rag doll. My middle child walked backward up a wall, an inhuman grace in his movements before he collapsed to the floor unconscious. The caseworker screamed. The nurse ran for help. They took my children away that night. In the quiet darkness of the empty house, I cried all alone that cold, terrible night with only that thing crouching in the other room. I fought, I prayed, I begged to God to take this curse away from my family. The priest returned, stronger this time, more prepared. He performed an exorcism on me first, 3 times. I don't remember much, just flashes of darkness, the feeling of something clawing inside my skin, trying to tear its way out. I remember screaming, though I don't recall if it was my voice or someone else's. On another night, I saw the thing in the window. I was lying in bed, exhausted, but too petrified to sleep. This heaviness came over me. Further back on the bed, pressure coming onto the bed. It crept up my legs. I gasped. I couldn't move. The room was dark, another darkness looming above me. He had no face, but his eyes, those eyes were disfigured as burnt embers filled with hatred, hunger, and some other sense, disdain.
"You'll never be free," a voice growled.
With sensation finally flowing again through my body, I leapt off the bed, gasping for air. It felt as though it had all turned to ash in the back of my throat. I ran. I took my keys and fled into the night without looking back until I reached, miles further, the church where Father Maganut waited. I sobbed. He pressed a crucifix into my hands, firm-fingered.
"Then we shall make it."
The last exorcism was different, intense, violent. The thing inside me, the thing inside my children, the thing inside the house fought back with a vengeance. Doors slammed, walls shook. My screams were interspersed with moments where I tried to shake off the thing weighing on me. It hissed in my ear, said things to me that I will never forget, but never utter. Then, suddenly, it was gone. The air cleaned. The house felt still. The darkness that had clung to me, to my children, to every square inch of that damned place lifted. We moved out, left it all behind, that house, and I never looked back. Years later, I learned the house got demolished. It was bought by Zach Baggins, filmed in a documentary, and then ultimately destroyed. But I know the thing that had tormented us hasn't vanished. Not really. Sometimes, late at night, when I close my eyes, I still hear the whispers.
"You'll never leave me."
Latoya Amons, an Indiana woman, claims she and her 3 children were tormented by demonic forces in their Gary, Indiana home in 2011. Dubbed the 200 Demon House case, the alleged hauntings included levitation, shadowy figures, and violent possessions. Amons sought help from police, doctors, and clergy, leading to an investigation by child services and law enforcement. A Catholic priest, Father Michael Maganut, performed multiple exorcisms on Amons, one sanctioned by the church. Official reports from police and medical staff described eerie, unexplainable events, adding to the case's notoriety. The home was later demolished by paranormal investigator Zach Baggins, who documented the case in his 2018 film, Demon House. Amons has since remained largely private, only occasionally speaking about her experiences, maintaining her belief that the house was infested with evil forces. The case remains one of the most controversial modern possession claims in the U.S.